Hi, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to center with you this morning. I figure that even though Purim is still a good full month away, as we always say, Mishan Nechnas Adar Marbin Besimcha, that once Adar comes, we sort of increase in happiness. And in my mind, that basically kind of means that Mishan Nechnas Adar, the spirit of Purim, is here. So even though there's still a month away, I figured that we would speak this morning about Megillat Esther, the sefer that we read on Purim. The central question that I think we have to ask ourselves whenever we read any book, whether it's a book of Tanakh or even just a novel, is always what's the central message or the central themes that the author is trying to convey to us with this book. Of course, when it comes to a book of Tanakh, that question becomes even more pressing than with a novel, since the author of Tanakh is God, or the Nevi'im conveying the message of God, and therefore the messages are even more important to glean than even if it was just a novel. So certainly when it comes to a book of Tanakh, we really have to take a step back. And after reading any book of Tanakh, again, true about a novel as well, but especially Tanakh, have to really take a step back and ask ourselves, okay, what is the central message or the central theme that we're supposed to be getting from this sefer? And the question happens to be a particularly difficult one when it comes to Megillat Esther. And I think some of the reason why it's a little hard is almost because of what a fun book it is. That to a certain extent, because it's such a fun story, and it's so gripping and just, you know, has so many twists and turns, that we almost sometimes forget to ask ourselves what's the message, because it's just so much fun to read that we just kind of enjoy the plot and enjoy the storyline, and therefore might sort of forget to ask, okay, but why did God want this story to be part of Tanakh? And especially the question is pressing, considering that one of the glaring omissions from the Megillah is the name of God. Nowhere in the whole Megillah is God's name ever mentioned. There isn't really much mention of prayer, of covenant, brit, any of the central law, right? There's no mitzvot in it. I mean, theoretically, one could argue at the end that the mitzvah of keeping the holiday of Purim is mentioned in it. But basically, the central elements that would usually make a book worthy of being included in Tanakh don't seem to be evident in the Megillah, and therefore, again, we really have to ask, so why did Hashem want this book to be part of Tanakh? Yet another element which sort of makes the question even more glaring is that when one reads through the Megillah, and again, a bunch of you may have noticed this in the past or maybe even read articles or heard you mention this idea before, is that when you read through the Megillah, something should basically be jumping out at us, which is that there are a ton of glaring parallels, both literarily and thematically, between the Megillah and the story of Yosef. So that as we read it, it should just be almost happening over and over again, and we should be like, hey, that sounds familiar. That's reminding me of the story in Bereishis with Yosef, which basically just enhances the first question about the message of whatever it is that the message is that God is trying to convey to us by including the Megillah in Tanakh. We have to also, it has to be able to explain how including all of these allusions to the story of Yosef enhances that message. That somehow whatever the message is has to, you know, be connected, or it has to make sense of all these connections to Yosef. That in what way do all these allusions to Yosef enhance or reinforce this central message that we're supposed to be conveying? In order, though, to even begin to address that, we first have to explain what are all these glaring parallels that I keep mentioning. So I actually even am curious to ask you, if any of you have noticed, don't look at the source sheets yet, although the source sheets won't even help, because the source sheets actually, I bring the literary parallels, the psukim, where there's just glaring similarities in the words that the author of the Megillah uses that really completely are paralleling language from the story of Yosef. But what I'm actually asking is, in terms of just the storyline, the simple straight plot line, they're such similar stories. And I'm actually curious to ask you, if nobody wants to, then I'm happy to share my own ideas. But I'm curious to hear if any of you have ever either thought about or heard about or noticed similarities between the story of Yosef and the story of Esther. Again, just in terms of the basic plot. Anyone want to share? Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'll get you next. Ah, interesting. Excellent. So already there's a mention that both sort of start from a lowly status. You began by mentioning that Yosef was in jail, and that to a certain extent Esther being in the palace was being in jail, although I would even perhaps bring it even to a different perspective, of both definitely start from a lowly status, Yosef being in jail, being hated by his brothers, being sold by his own family, completely abandoned, left alone, Esther was also essentially abandoned by her family, not on purpose, as it was with Yosef, but Ema Avvaim is the first thing that we're told about her, that she was an orphan. So both of them are sort of alone in the world, in this very lowly status, abandoned, almost to a certain extent, the lowest level of society to a certain extent, abandoned, left alone, and yet have this meteoric rise that not only are they able to overcome the fact that they begin by being all abandoned and alone in jail, even an orphan, not only are they able to overcome that and sort of make it okay, they become the second in command. And in fact, what's even glaring is the fact that it's not even just that they become a position of power. They become literally second only to the king. Where the lashon that's actually used by Paro in talking to Yosef is Rak hakisei egdal mimecha. Paro even says to Yosef, I will not sort of exceed your greatness in anything except for the throne. I mean, Yosef could, you know, was just an inch away, so to speak, you know, from being the king, the Pharaoh himself, even though he had started off abandoned by his family and in jail. So too with Esther, starts as an orphan, everything like that, and yet the lashon that Ahasuerus uses is Ar chatzi hamalchut vateas. I will even give you and grant you up to half of my kingdom. Again, it's just striking that similarity of starting from sort of the lowest of the low and having this meteoric rise to power, being literally second only to the king. Yeah, somebody else was mentioning something. Excellent. In both, their physical beauty is actually emphasized. Now, when is, because the lashon is so similar, it's actually even mentioned on the sheet, in source number 5. Oh, wait, is it 5? Let me just find. No, sorry, source number 4, where it describes both of their beauty, and it even uses the similar lashon of v'hanara yifat tor v'tovat mar'eh in describing Esther. That's how it describes her beauty. And so too by Yosef, v'yihi Yosef yifei tor v'yifei mar'eh, even uses, A, the fact that the psukim focus on their physical beauty, and even use similar language to describe their physical beauty. Excellent. Which actually brings them to another, yeah, I'll take yours. Gonna... They both what? Excellent, right? Is that they both use the fact that they were second in command. Theoretically, it could have just been the story about, you know, a Jew who, you know, makes it big. But it wasn't just that they make it big. They use their authority as second in command to the king to save the Jewish people. And I think what's interesting is that they do it in a very similar way. Meaning, at first glance, actually, I was thinking that they're the only two people who ever made it, sort of Jews who made it that high, being second in command. And then I was thinking, you know what, to a certain extent, maybe one could say Moshe. And then I realized it's actually quite the opposite. Because Moshe, in order to save the Jewish people, had to abandon being, you know, part of Paro's household. Whereas Yosef and Esther, not only do they not abandon sort of their positions of authority, they specifically save the Jews through their being second in command in these positions of authority. So I think that's also a very interesting point. And in addition, what's strikingly similar about both of them is that in both of their cases, though, they use their position of authority in the foreign court to save the Jews in a hidden way, though, right? Meaning neither of them are sort of openly Jewish and therefore sort of save their nation by just being publicly out there as from Jews. They both specifically do it by having to hide their identities. In fact, both of them, A, even have hidden names, right? Like Yosef, we're told explicitly in the Psukim, was called Safnat Pa'aneach, actually, in Mitzrayim. And you and Esther as well, really, it's, you know, Hadassah was actually, you know, her Jewish name. So they both have hidden identities, hidden names. They both use their meteoric rise to power to save the Jews, but not by being publicly, I'm Jewish and therefore, you know, I'm going to help my people, but only through hidden means. Anybody else? Because there's actually a lot of more things about that. Yeah. Yes. Excellent. That's actually exactly where I was going to go next. Excellent. Is that not only do both of them have hidden identities and use that sort of to save the Jews, but there's a lot of subterfuge involved. In fact, if you think about it, both of them do it in really, again, almost an identical type of way. Interestingly, both have a party where they invite their adversary almost in order to confuse them, right? By Esther, it's very clear, right? She has the party, invites Haman, sort of gives him this false sense of security before she sort of, you know, turns the tables on him. So too with Yosef, when the brothers first come down to Mitzrayim, he basically invites them to this huge feast, and they're completely confused. What's going on here? And then he turns the tables on them and accuses them of spying, right? So it's almost identical. And then right after, you know, sort of having these parties and then confusing and turning the tables on them, in both cases, is also, there's this like shocking moment of revelation, which is a result of having their hidden identities. You can obviously only have a moment of revelation if you've been hiding it till now. But these very powerful moments, where of course with Yosef, it's the famous line where he suddenly reveals himself to his brothers and says, "Ani Yosef ha'od avichai." So too with Esther, right, at the second party, where she says, you know, Tachashverosh, after he's been begging and pleading, "Please, Esther, tell me what's on your mind." And she suddenly, you know, he's expecting, you know, her to ask for some provinces or something like that, riches. And instead she says, you know, "Tinatein li nafshi b'she'elati v'ami b'vakashati. Kinim karnu ani v'ami l'hashmi l'arogu l'abed." Instead of asking for riches, wealth, something like that, she basically says, "Save my life. My life is at stake, and I'm a Jew." Which again, and then it even continues with the, also the revelation where Hamelech Achashverosh, he's shocked, and he says, "Mihu ze ve'eze hu asher, you know, milei libo lasot kein, v'tome Esther, ish tzar ve'oyev haman hara hazeh," right? And it's almost that same feeling that you have when Yosef reveals himself and is, "Ani Yosef ha'od avichai," and you can almost picture the shock on the brothers' faces. So to hear, it's that same type of a moment of revelation and the shock when sort of the true identity of everybody involved in the story is revealed. I'll just mention another one just because it's also very surprising, and we'll look at some of the literary ones. Is interestingly, they both also, the rise to power that we've discussed, in both cases begins with troubled sleep of the king, which is again, it's just interesting that it's a sort of surprising element of both, not something you would expect, and it's in both stories. How, of course, with Achashverosh, it's the famous line of "Balayla hahu nadidashna panelech," that night his sleep was disturbed, and that's why he asked for the sefer zichronot to be revealed, and he remembers about Mordechai and everything like that. And with Paro, Yosef's whole rise begins because Paro has the dreams that he doesn't know how to interpret, and Yosef comes and interprets them. So again, it's just a lot of striking parallels in terms of the storyline. And then in addition to all of these similarities in terms of the plot, if you look at the sheet, we won't go through all of them, I'll just point out two or three of the most glaring ones, it becomes clear that the author of the Megillah was extremely and acutely aware of the similarities in the stories, because not only are sort of their similarities in terms of the plot line, but in writing the words of the Megillah, the author uses over and over again the same lashon, the exact same wording as Hashem uses in writing the story of Yosef. So just to give a few examples, actually the one that really first caught my eye the most, if you look at 14 first, just because in my mind it's really the one that sort of sets off the warning bells, is that the word Vayit Apak, again it's number 14 in the chart, only appears two times in the entire Chumash. It shows up a few times in the rest of Nach, but in Chumash it only shows up two times in the entire Chumash HaChumshei Torah, and both of them are in the story of Yosef. Basically, the word means to sort of not be able to like hold oneself back, like he had, or sorry, the opposite. Yeah, it's to be able to hold oneself back. Lo yochol Yosef litapek, he couldn't hold himself back, to hold oneself back. And basically, again, the only two times in all of Chumash HaChumshei Torah that it shows up is these two times in the story of Yosef. And yet it shows up also in the story of the Megillah, that in Esther Parakei Pasuk Yud, it says, Vayita Pak Haman Vayavoel Beito, that he had to sort of hold himself back from all of, you know, the upsetting things that he's experiencing, and he went home. And again, when you see that, the word, it should almost right away like set off all these warning bells of, hey, that rings bells of the story of Yosef. But there are many, many others, as you can see. If you even just look at number three, the description, the words that are used in describing the way that Achashverosh gathers together all of the bitulot when he wants to choose a replacement for Vashti is Vayafkeid Hamelch Pikidim, right? He sort of sets up all these like officers. Vayikbitsu et kol na'ara bitulat tovat mareh. They gather together all of the bitulot in the, you know, kingdom. Vayitafa davar be'enei Hamelch Vayaskin. And it was sort of a good idea, meaning they had suggested it and it's a good idea to him. And if you look at the other side of the chart, at the Yosef side, again in number three, it uses the exact same lashon, paralleling exactly the lashon used when they were describing the way that Yosef suggests to Achashverosh to basically gather all of the food during the time of plenty to supply for the time of famine. As it says, Ve'afkeid pikidim al ha'art, right? Again, that same lashon of Ve'afkeid pikidim, they sort of, you know, divided up and set up officials. Vayikbitsu, that same lashon, et kol ochel hashnim hatavot, they'll gather all the food of the good years. Vayitav hatavar b'nei paro b'nei kol avadav. And it was a good idea in the eyes of Paro. Again, it's just the same language. Again, if you look through the chart, there's tons more, but I'll just point out one last one. If you turn to the second side, if you look at basically sources 16, 18, and 20, the lashon also that's used in describing the honor that Ahasuerus grants to Mordechai when he's basically, remember when he, the whole irony where he asks Haman, how should I reward a person who has helped the king, and Haman, you know, gives all these grandiose descriptions thinking it's him, and then turns out it's Mordechai. It's almost the identical lashon as what was described in terms of all the honors that Paro bestowed upon Yosef. Again, if you look at 16, it's basically 16, 18, and 20, all the different descriptions, it's almost the same type of thing where they dress them in big day sheish, and then he rides him on the horses, on the king's horse. There's somebody calling out before him. The whole thing, and then he gives him his ring, and the way that it supposedly says that he goes milifnei hamelach, all the words are just so similar that it really rings a bell. So it really is parallel. And actually, it also reminds me of one last thing that's just interesting between Esther and Yosef, is that they're always finding favor in everybody's eyes, right? Like, and that's partially how they actually have these meteoric rise to power from being so low to being second in command. You know, by Yosef, he first is most beloved among his brothers to Yaakov. Then he finds favor in Potiphar's eyes. Then in the jailer's eyes, right? Even the jailer likes him. Then in Paro's eyes. Everybody that they meet just loves them. So too with Esther, it first describes how Hegai Sris HaMelech, right? The one who was in charge of watching all the betulot, so somehow he takes a special liking to her and gives her all the best stuff. And then, of course, you know, Ahasuerus takes a special liking to her. And it even says at one point that Vatisachin Be'ini Chol Ro'eha, everyone who saw her liked her. They both also have that similarity that just everybody falls in love with them sort of the second that they meet them. Either way, hopefully I've convincingly shown at this point. And again, there's tons more parallels, which, you know, when you have time, you could take a look and see them. Tons and tons of parallels between the stories of Yosef and Esther. But again, all that we've done so far showed the parallels. What all this raises, though, is the question of why. Why are there all these parallels? Why did the author of the Megillah make all these allusions to the story of Yosef? And again, I would assume that that has to do with whatever the message is that he's trying to convey. So again, all this has really done is just build our question even stronger. So what is the message we're supposed to be getting from the Megillah? And then sort of the second part of it, and how does, you know, all these continuous allusions to Yosef enhance that message? So far, we've really just built up the question. We still have to get to seeing the answer. So to begin to address the answer, I think that really one of the key elements to really grasping the message of the Megillah lies in appreciating the time period when the Megillah took place. And I have to say that that question of when historically did Megillah Esther take place never even occurred to me to ask, like for years and years. Like for so many years, I just sort of read the Megillah as like this really fun, interesting story, just sort of isolated in time, like in a vacuum, so to speak. Like I never like thought to ask what else was going on in the world or in Jewish history at the time. However, a few years ago, I read an article by Rav Menachem Mittag online. It's still available online, I bet, so if any of you are interested, you can take a look, where he asked this question of historically, in what era did this take place? And basically what he ends up pointing out is a totally earth-shattering, at least for me, point about the Megillah, which is that the Megillah took place during the time of Shivat Zion, the time when the Jews were already given permission to return to Israel. So let me just give some background as to what that time means, and I'll explain why that is so earth-shattering and, like, totally, for all time, change my perception of the Megillah. Basically, just in a quick two-minute thumbnail sketch, what happens historically is that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, destroyed the first Beit HaMikdash, and in contrast to the current gullus that we're in, where we unfortunately have no idea, you know, when it will end, Yirmiyahu actually prophesied in advance that first gullus will only last for 70 years. The Jews actually, even in gullus, knew that in just 70 years it's going to end. And in fact, 70 years later, that's exactly what happened. Koresh, the king of Persia, Paras, conquered Babel, and in I think it was either the first or the second, it's explicit in Ezra, a year of his reign, gave permission for the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael and begin building the Beit HaMikdash. Now, there's a lot of debate about which, historical debate among historians and things like that, about which Persian king exactly Ahasuerus was. But everybody agrees, because it explicitly calls him the king of Paras Umadai, that he was a Persian king. Now, it was the very first Persian king, Koresh, who gave the Jews permission to return to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, which means that regardless of which Persian king Ahasuerus was, since he was a Persian king, and obviously he wasn't the first one, Koresh was the first, he lived, which means this whole story took place after permission was given to the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. The reason that, in my mind, this was so earth-shattering and really changed my whole perspective of the Megillah is that until I read that article, of course we always view Mordechai and Esther as these completely heroic characters, right? Like up on this pedestal who, like, could do nothing wrong, right? Suddenly, when you realize that this whole story is taking place after Shivat Zion, after permission was granted to the Jews to return to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, suddenly it's like, well, Esther and Mordechai, like, what are you doing in Shushan to begin with? Like, why are you here? Why did you get yourselves into this trouble to begin with? Like, basically, again, to a large extent, and we'll come back and understand why in the end they are heroes, but it really makes you sort of question, like, hey, they could have avoided all this trouble if they had just done what they were supposed to do to begin with and had gone to Eretz Yisrael, gone to help, you know, rebuild the Jewish nation, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, then they wouldn't have been in Ahasuerus's kingdom to begin with and wouldn't have had all this trouble. And it really makes us ask, what were they doing there, especially if they were Jewish leaders, which Mordechai certainly it seems like he was. Why was he still in Persia? Why had he not returned to Eretz Yisrael? And what even makes it, to a certain sense, even more powerful, and Menachem Liebtag actually mentions this in his article, though I actually saw it in several articles subsequently, is their names, which at this point is interesting, because now Mordechai and Esther are like totally classic Jewish names. But at the time of the Megillah, not only were they not Jewish names, they were like as goyish as you could get. That basically the name Mordechai is actually a play on the word Marduk, who is the god of creation, like the pagan god of creation. And Esther, of course, as we know, her name was really Hadassah, was her Jewish name. It's from Astarte, which is the goddess of fertility. So basically, again, to each, and actually the Gemara in Menachos Samachem at Aleph mentions that Mordechai's real name was Patathia. So meaning they each had Jewish names, Hadassah and Patathia, and then they were sort of going by these, like, very goyish names that are sort of reminiscent of pagan gods. Again, it's just sort of making us question, hey, if these are supposed to be like our heroes of the story, what are they doing in Shushan instead of being in Eretz Yisrael helping rebuild the Beis HaMikdash? Why do they have these extremely goyish names? Like, just what's going on here? And interestingly, this whole problem of sort of having Jews still remaining in Shushan or in other foreign lands, even though permission has already been granted to the Jews to return, actually seems to have been a very, very widespread problem of the time. Meaning it doesn't seem as if, and in fact it's proven by the fact that it's not like Mordechai and Esther were the only Jews that were going to be killed by Haman. There were tons and tons of Jews still in Persia. That it was, I mean, it's explicit in a lot of the Nevi'im Achronim. It was a huge problem of the time of Shivat Zion that a lot of the Jews, in fact, did not sort of take the message that they were supposed to and did not return and were sort of too comfortable in the homes that they had already established for themselves in Galus and therefore did not return. In fact, just one set of psukim that I brought for you, although there's a whole bunch, because a lot of the Nevi'im Achronim are actually yelling at the Jews, go! Like, what are you doing still sitting in Galus? But one set of psukim that I brought is on the last page of the source sheet, number 25, from Haggai Perek Aleph. So if you just flip for a second, you'll see. I'll just show you those psukim so that you can see, you know, that it really was a very widespread problem. But just by the way, before we read these, Ezra and Nehemiah were yelling at the Jews, how come you didn't all go? And it was a huge problem about all the Jews who were intermarried. Like, the assimilation and just the apathy, the lack of excitement about going to Beis HaMikdash was a very widespread problem at the time. So if you look again at source 25, Haggai Perek Aleph, he basically comes, starting, I'll just start from Pasuk Bet, where the Navi, the Nebuah that he gives is, Komar Hashem Tzivakot Le'mor, God says as follows, Ha'am haze amu lo ipo ipeit Hashem hibanot. The nation is saying, it's not really time yet to go build a Beis HaMikdash. We're sort of comfortable here. We'd rather stay where we are. Vahi dvar Hashem v'yad Chagai Hanavi Le'mor. And so the word of Hashem came to Chagai Hanavi saying, Ha'et lachem atem lashtevet bevatechem sunim v'habayit hazeh harev. Is it time now for you to be sitting in your beautiful paneled houses while my house, while this house, the Beis HaMikdash, is sitting in waste and in ruins and is all destroyed? And he basically continues and says, you know, simu levav chamal darchechem, pay attention to your ways. And he continues and describes how they're planting a lot and yet not having good harvest. And, you know, they're eating but not really being full. And he then continues in Zion and says, komar shem sevakot, simu levav chamal darchechem, it should have a dal there. He repeats again, pay attention to your ways. And he says in Chet really very strongly, alu hahar, go up to the mountain, v'havetanet, go get wood, ubenu habayit, like go build the Beis HaMikdash, like get off, you know, from sitting on you know, your tush, and go and build the Beis HaMikdash. Like, what are you doing just sitting in your comfortable home? My house is still destroyed, and you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And he can do again, he's saying, alu hahar, v'havetanet, ubenu habayit, go up, get wood, build the house already. Ve'er tebo, and I'll be happy with it, I'll take pleasure in it. Ve'ikavdan, I'll be glorified in it, Amar Hashem, Hashem says. And he even continues then, and he says, Pano harbe, you've been turning to a lot, v'hine lema'at, meaning you think you're going to get a lot, but little is coming, v'avetem habai, you bring it home, v'nafaktibo, because I'm basically blowing away everything that you're trying to plant or to grow or to succeed in, I'm not sort of letting work. And he says, ya'ana, why am I not letting this work? Nu Hashem Tzvakot, ya'an beiti asher hu chareva, temrati mishleito, because of my house, which is sitting in waste and destruction, and you're running each man to his house, just sort of worried about your own little, you know, daladamos of what's going on in your own house. So basically, again, what's clear, and this is just one of a few examples among the Nevi'im Achronim, where it seems that Mordechai and Esther are not the only ones who sort of were in Shushan, even though they shouldn't have been. It really was a very widespread problem that even though permission was granted to return to Eretz Yisrael and build the Beis HaMikdash, that a lot of them really were not going. And in fact, the Gemara in Megillah Yebet Amin Aleph actually asked the question of Lama, you know, Nitchayvu Klaya. I mean, you kind of have to ask, to a certain extent, again, we always view the Megillah as this very positive story, a happy story, because ultimately the Jews are saved. But to a certain extent, you might have to ask, well, to begin with, why did they deserve near extinction? Like, why did they come this close? And one of the answers that the Megillah famously gives is because of the fact that they had enjoyed Ahasuerus's party. You may be familiar with that. It's one of the famous answers that's given. And basically, Chazal then asks, why was that such a big deal? Okay, so they had all the food and drink at his party. Why would that enjoying his party be enough to make him worthy of destruction? And Chazal explained, and actually that's partially why when we read the Megillah, pay attention, when we read the thing that when it's describing the party and it says, Vishotim mikelim shonim, we read it in the tune of Eicha. And Chazal said the reason why we read that phrase in the tune of Eicha is that Ahasuerus brought the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash to the party and was basically partying with them because what the party was made for was that Ahasuerus had miscalculated the 70 years, thought they were over, and is celebrating that basically that the Churban is permanent and that the Jews were wrong and they're not really going to be able to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, for the Jews to participate in such a party, again, really just highlighted how much it didn't get them in their guts that, like, we shouldn't be here and we should be, you know, going to Israel and helping build the Beis HaMikdash and everything like that. And so it seems as if, again, that this was a widespread problem and that Mordechai and Esther were just sort of, again, as the leaders, part of that. So that sort of gives some of the historical background. The question then is, if all this is true, well then hey, why are these our heroes? Like, basically, we do view them as our heroes, and a lot of, you know, people do, in fact, name their children Mordechai and Esther and everything like that. So now that we've sort of explained why perhaps they deserve the near extinction to begin with, and what some of the background is, well then what's going on here? How do we sort of rehabilitate them in our eyes so that we can once again view them as the heroes that we know they're supposed to be? And I think that really, in fact, what we've just said in terms of explaining the apathy and the lack of, you know, getting up and going and everything like that we've just explained actually can be used to even more fully appreciate where the true heroism of Mordechai, and especially Esther, and I think that's why perhaps it's called Megillat Esther, not Megillat Mordechai or Mordechai but Esther, where their heroism truly lies. And that is that we can really see over the course of the Megillah the unbelievable, like, really, you'll see, it's literal a transformation, unbelievable transformation that Esther undergoes in terms of her personality and her character from the way that she is in the beginning of the Megillah to the way that she is at the end. And I think that largely the reason why she and Mordechai, but again, focusing specifically on Esther, who is the namesake of the Megillah, focusing on her, I think we'd actually appreciate that precisely what makes her so heroic was that she begins the Megillah with the same sort of problem that characterized her entire generation, this apathy, this just lack of caring and lack of just get up and go. She was a perfect classic representative of that. But she doesn't end the Megillah that way. In fact, she becomes and transforms herself into the polar opposite. And I think that that is exactly where her greatness lies. And ultimately, I think that that is one of the central messages of the Megillah, both certainly for her time period, that she really ultimately becomes the leader par excellence because of beginning as just yet another representative of the apathy of the times and yet totally transforms herself into the opposite. So the perfect heroine for that time period, but I also even think a perfect heroine for all ages for us as well. So let's take a look and see that transformation happen. So basically, the way that Esther is introduced to us in the beginning of the Megillah is, as I'm saying, the polar opposite of the person that she is at the end. If you take a look, I brought the psukim that really are from the first parak, which is where we're first introduced to her, which is parak Bet, starting from source number 22. That if you notice, the Esther that we're introduced to in the beginning of the Megillah is basically this totally passive character. And we'll take a look and we'll see almost every single verb that is used in relation to Esther in the beginning of the Megillah is a passive verb. It's always describing things being done to her or for her or her simply following the command that somebody else has given her. It's glaring how, like, there almost could not be a more passive character if we tried to create one. She doesn't take action at all. Let's take a look and see that. And again, I think that shows how she was just the classic representative of just this apathy of her times. Take a look, you'll see. First of all, the very way that she's even introduced us for the first time, in contrast to Mordechai, who's introduced in Esther Perek Bet Pasuk Hei as Ish Yehudi Hayab Shushan Habira, right? There was a Jewish man and we're introduced by name and everything like that. The way that Esther's introduced us is in Pasuk Zayin. She's only even introduced as Vayhi Omenet Hadassah. She's introduced even as only like an appendage of Mordechai, like a ward, like almost not even as a character in her own right. It's almost like, oh, well, we'll just mention her because we're really talking about Mordechai. And he happens to have had this, you know, niece that he was, or again, wife, the midrash, something he says, but whatever, this, for now we'll just say niece that he's taking care of because of the fact that she was orphaned. So she's even, the way she's even introduced to us is not as this, like, you know, by he, you know, whatever, Ish Yehudi Hayah, and then Ish Yehudiya or something, Isha Yehudiya, whatever, it's just, and she was Mordechai's ward. And then continuing on, at the end of that Pasuk Zayin, it again then says, Uvemot Aviyah Vihima, that once, you know, upon the death of her parents, Likacha Mordechai Lo Levad, right? Mordechai takes her, again, it's actually being done to her. Continuing then in Pasuk Chet, right, that Vayhi Vishamad Dvar HaMelech V'dato, that basically when the whole pronouncement went out that Ahasuerus is gathering all the Betulot, basically, so Shushan Habiral Yahigai, but Tilakach Esther Beit HaMelech. Right. Once again, she is taken. Everything is passive. Continuing on, it then in Pasuk Yud, it then is describing how she's then in the king's palace, and it says Lohi Ida Esther Etamaviat Muladatah. Right. She doesn't tell her nation or her birthplace. Ki Mordechai Tivah Halasher Lo Tagid. It's not that she realized it might be a bad idea. She's just following Mordechai's commands. Then even continuing in Pasuk Yud Aleph, right, it describes how Mordechai would go every single day outside the king's palace to know what's going on with Esther, and it says, right, so Vayhi Yom Yom, Yom Bayom, Mordechai Mitalech Lefnei Chatzar Beit Hanashim, Ladat Et Shlom Esther, to know what's going on, Uma Ye'aseba, not in what she's doing, and what's being done to her. Everything is always just being done to her. It then in the next few psukim just describes the whole process by which Betulot would go into Ahasuerus, and then, so it doesn't relate directly to Esther, and Pasuk Ted Vav, it's finally Esther's turn. And it says, Uvahagi, right, when finally it's Esther's turn to come before the king, even when it simply came to being her turn to go before Ahasuerus, she didn't even ask for, like, even when it came to simply asking for, like, a, you know, a stick of lipstick or something, even that, like, small thing she didn't do for herself. The only thing she would take is whatever Hegai Shomer HaNashim would sort of say, okay, Esther, you take this. Again, total passivity. She's not making any decisions, taking any actions for herself. Continuing on in Tet Zayin, Vatilakach Esther El HaMelech Achashverosh, she's taken to Achashverosh, and then of course he finds favor and decides to, you know, crown her as queen. And the final sort of clincher that just sort of basically sums up the entire introduction of her that we've had in the whole parak is the last line in Pasuk Chaf, where it continues and it says, Ein Esther Magedet Melad Tavi Atama, even as she's queen, she still continues this policy of not telling her birthplace or her nation. Ka'asher Tzivah Le'a Mordechai, but once again, it's not because she decided it was a bad idea, it's as Mordechai commanded her. And here's really the clincher where it says, V'et Ma'amar Mordechai Esther Asa, Ka'asher Haitav V'amna Ito. And basically, even when she's queen of the land, she doesn't do anything except what Mordechai tells her to do, exactly as it was when she was still living in his household as, you know, as his ward. So it's really just striking that, again, here she is even undergoing this whole meteoric rise to power, becoming the queen of the land, and yet, again, there's virtually not one single active verb, not one single decision she makes, not one single action that she takes of her own accord. Everything is simply being done to her. You know, she's simply just following everybody else's commands. However, what we see, and I really think it's one of the most remarkable parts of the Megillah, is really tracing her development, because she totally and completely and utterly changes personality over the course of the Megillah. And the real transformation takes place in Perek Dalet. So if you take a look, that's actually the next set of sources, and source number 23 is where this whole transformation takes place. That basically what happens in Perek Dalet, that's the parak where basically the whole decree has come out from Haman that he's going to destroy all the Jews. And as a result, all the Jews have already heard about this horrible decree. And therefore, Mordechai's in fasting. He's wearing sackcloth and everything like that. And all the Jews are in mourning. But Esther, because she's isolated in the palace, All she knows is that she can see that Mordechai is wearing sackcloth and all the Jews are mourning, but she, being isolated in the palace, doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know why everyone is displaying all this mourning. And therefore, she basically sends one of her messengers, Hathach, to basically go to Mordechai and ask him, like, what's going on? Why are you dressed like this? What's going on? And basically, of course, as we know, Mordechai famously sends back the message through Hathach to Esther, describing to her about this horrible thing that has transpired, that Haman wants to destroy all the Jews, and that's why we're all in mourning. But not only does Mordechai tell her about the horrible plot that Haman has launched, but he actually then continues and he says, this is in Pasuk Chet, I'll just start from the beginning so you can see the context. So again, it's on, I think, the last page of the sources, in Perek Dalet Pasuk Chet. That basically he gives Hathach to show to Esther the letters that have gone out saying that all the Jews are going to be destroyed. And then he says, and here's the critical line, I underlined it in Pasuk Chet, ulitzavot aleha lavo el hamelch yitchanema ulevakesh milfanav al ama. That basically he said, Mordechai gives to Hathach the letter, show Esther the decree that has gone out against us, and he tells Hathach, command Esther to go and plead our case before the king Ahasuerus. Once again, so far, this is total classic pattern of exactly what we've seen, right? Mordechai is giving commands to Esther. However, when Hathach comes and in fact tells Esther the message, she basically refuses. This is the first time that we're seeing her refuse, but of course in this case it's not a good thing, it's a bad thing. She's only refusing because of her paralysis and her fear and still her passivity and inability to take action. As we see in Yud Aleph, where she basically says, "Kol avdei hamelech v'am medinot hamelech yodin, everybody knows, asher kol ish v'isha asher yavo al hamelech el chater p'tinit asher lo yikarei, that any man or woman who comes before the inner, you know, sanctuary of the king who has not been summoned, achat datol lahamit, that basically Ahasuerus has one policy for anyone who does that, which is to execute them. Levan ma'asher yoshid lo hamelech et shervit hazahav v'chaya, unless he would stretch out his, you know, scepter to this person, and the person will live. And I have not been called to the king for 30 days. So basically she's refusing, but again, not because she's, say, taking action, only because, once again, she's sort of afraid to rock the boat. She's afraid to do anything that she's not supposed to be doing. Ahasuerus hasn't called her. She's therefore not supposed to go. She doesn't want to do anything that's not sort of exactly what she's supposed to be doing. However, Mordechai then continues, and, you know, so Hathach goes, you know, and relates Esther's message to Mordechai. And then Mordechai says back to Yud Gimel, and here comes the turning point, actually, right after this. He responds, and then her response back. He says, "Vayomer Mordechai l'Shiva Esther." He once again tells Hathach, go tell this message back to Esther. "Al tidami b'nafsheich l'imaleit beit hamelch mikol Yehudim." Don't imagine in your heart that you, among all the Jews, are going to be the lone one to escape because of the fact that you're in the king's palace. Because if you remain silent at this critical moment of Jewish history, when you finally have the chance to really make a difference, if you dare to remain silent at this moment, somehow God will find another way to save us. But you and your father's house will be lost. And who knows, if maybe it wasn't for this precise moment and for this precise reason to be able to step in and save your nation, if maybe this is the very reason why you were zocha to basically become the queen of the land. That is the powerful message that Mordechai gives back to her, of basically saying, don't you dare be silent now. Don't you dare think that because you're afraid for your life, and because you think that you really aren't in danger because you're in the king's palace, that therefore it's okay for you to remain silent and for you to step back and just sort of let events transpire as they will. We'll be saved somehow else. I don't doubt it that God will figure out a way to save us. But this is your moment when you are supposed to get up and take action and show what you're made of and use the power and the authority and the position that God has given you. This is what he gave it to you for. So get up and do what you're supposed to do with it. And finally, here is really where we see, and from this moment on, Esther is a different person. And she responds by saying, "Vatomer Esther Lashiv el Mordechai." Esther tells Hathach to relate to Mordechai. in Pasuk Tetzayin, Lech Kinos et Kol HaYehudim. And this ascension, it's already the fourth parak of the Megillah, we're almost halfway through, and this is the first time that we see Esther make a command of her own. But from this moment on, that is all that we'll see her doing, is her taking action, and her making decisions, and her basically calling the shots. But this is the first time, this is really the turning point in the Megillah, was when at first she refuses, and Mordechai gives her that muster and says, don't you dare be silent. This is what you are here for. And she responds by saying, she gets the message and she says, Lech kinos et kol yudim. Go and gather all the Jews. Hanimtzim b'shushan, that are found in Shushan, v'tzumu alai. And fast for me and don't eat and don't drink for 3 days. And basically I'm going to go, you know, before the king, v'kasher v'adzi v'adzi. And if I am lost, I am lost. But you are right. This is my mission in life. This is what I am here for. And I am going to take the bull by the horns and I'm going to do what I need to do, no matter what the personal risk might be. And then, and this is like so glaring and so powerful, if you look in at the next pasuk, Yitzayin, where it says, Vayavor Mordechai, Vayas kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. He went and he did everything that Esther commanded him. And if you've been tracing Esther's personality and the whole relationship between the two the whole time, this pasuk is like amazing. It's like so powerful because it's literally the exact opposite of everything that we've been seeing till now. Till now, he was giving all the commands, and Esther was just almost like his puppet, just doing whatever it is that he said to do. From now on, the tables are turned, and it's a completely different story. And Esther is a different person after this conversation. And now Mordechai is the one doing everything that Esther commands him to do. And she's the one who's making the decisions and calling all the shots. And she has completely changed. And in my mind, really, my favorite pasuk in the whole Megillah, and I think really the one that if I had to choose one pasuk from the Megillah that really captures the message of the Megillah is actually the next one on the source sheet. Source number 24 from Esther Perkhet, where here is really where I just think is the climax of her transformation. The transformation occurs in Perek Dalet in the pasukim that we just read, but the pasuk which captures it the best, I think, is that pasuk in Perkhet. Just to give the background of the pasuk, it was right after she had revealed herself at the party as being a Jew and basically reveals Haman as being this Ishtar V'Oyev, and he's already been hung. But even after that happened, Esther had to go back a second time to King Ahasuerus to plead for him to overturn the letters that have already gone out. And so she's actually putting her life at risk a second time, because a second time he has to stretch out the sharbit to her, the scepter. But she says this time when she goes, and again this time is when she's going to plead on behalf that the Jews should be able to save themselves, and she says, Ki eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'ra'a asharim satami. Ve'eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'abdan muladati. How could I possibly sit back and just watch this terrible tragedy befall my nation? And how could I possibly just sit back and watch my nation be destroyed? And the reason I think that pasuk is so powerful is because it's the exact opposite of what she wanted to do before. That when Mordechai had initially sent her the message asking her to go plead before the king, and she basically said, I can't, and I'm too scared, and nobody's allowed to go. And Mordechai said to her, Im hacharesh tacharishi be'et hazot, if you dare be silent now. And now she's exactly taken the message and she said, how could I possibly be silent? She's almost echoing that same sentiment, but this time it's really coming from her gut, is this sense of, eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'ra'a asharim satami. How could I possibly just sit back and watch this terrible thing happen to my nation? I don't care what the personal cost might be, what the risk might be. I could not possibly just sit back and watch this happen. And therefore, what we've really seen over the course of this Megillah is Esther's complete and utter transformation from a passive character, but it's not just passivity. It's apathy. It's a lack of caring. Because somebody who cares enough wouldn't be able to just sit back and watch these terrible things happen. But what we see is that over the course of the Megillah, again, the real transformation happens in the Pesukim in Dalet, but again, it really comes to a climax, I think, in that Pesuk in Periklet, where she completely changes herself from being, again, not just somebody who's passive, but somebody who's just apathetic, who just doesn't care enough to sort of get up and do anything in life. Anything in general, again, everything in her life until that point is passive and just following everybody else's commands. But even when it came to saving the lives of her nation, just couldn't sort of get up enough passion to be willing to do something about it. And then she really totally and completely transforms herself by the end of the Megillah into the exact opposite, into a person who says, Eichacha uchal v'ra'iti b'ra'a asharim satami. How could I possibly just sit back and watch this thing happen to my nation? I couldn't possibly just sit by and watch. I had to get up and take action. And I think, therefore, that really, I think, can answer a lot of questions, and then we'll go back and understand how this relates to the Yosef thing. But in terms of the central message of the Megillah, in my mind, I really think that this, that watching the transformation of Esther, is to me the central message that I take from the Megillah, is this notion of somebody who really becomes, to a certain extent, we could even take in the specific realm of sort of Aliyah, because to a certain extent, we're also in a time where we have the ability to go to Israel, but we're all here, so we won't speak about that right now. But forgetting that specific element of the, you know, getting up and going to Israel, which was really her nation's problem in general, and hers in particular at that time. But in general, just this notion of feeling in your gut the pain of the Jewish nation. But that's the specific even thing here. But even just caring about anything, care about where you are and what's happening to you and what's going on in your life and what's going on in the world around you, in particular, especially, about the Jewish nation and about your community and about the people around you. And that if you can possibly do something to help, even if it might come at some personal risk or some personal cost or anything like that, in my mind, that's the message of the Megillah, is the not being a person who can feel the hacharesh tacharishi, that ability of, well, and again, her fear was understandable and was justified. Her life was at stake. But basically, in my mind, that is really what we see going on through the Megillah, is this transformation from a hacharesh tacharishi perspective of just sort of sitting back and letting things happen into being a person who feels, Eichacha uchav re'iti ba'asher yimtzatami. How could I possibly just sit back and watch this thing happen to my nation? And I think, as we saw, that really can explain the heroism, the true heroism of Esther. That to a certain extent, again, and also can answer the whole thing that to a certain extent almost made it difficult to understand, if they were at Shivat Zion and were still in Shushan, you know, then how come, you know, they're such heroes? It's precisely because of that. Meaning, I think that she was the perfect heroine for that time, because of the fact that she so perfectly captured the problem of that time, which was sort of the apathy and the just sitting back and letting things happen and not sort of, you know, taking action. But then she transforms herself and shows how she's not going to be that type of person, and completely becomes the polar opposite, somebody who can't just sit by and watch, but must take action and must work to use whatever talents or position or anything that she has to be able to help her nation. So I think that explains the message of the Megillah, and also explains her true heroism, and also helps us appreciate why the time setting of the Megillah is so critical. Because when you put this message, again, I think applies in any time period, but especially again in that time period of Shivat Zion, where the apathy was the real malaise of the time, they specifically, even more than at any other time, although again, I think it's true of any time, really needed that message of not being a hacharesh tacharishi type of person, but the eichacha uchav re'iti ba'asher yimtzatami type of person. So it helps really pull together the significance of the time period and why she was actually the perfect heroine for that time, but again, I think for all time as well, in really seeing her whole development. But again, I think it's a message that is certainly as relevant today as it was then. The question, though, that this all still we have to get back to is, what about all those parallels to Yosef that we brought in the beginning? We still have to get back to that and explain. Okay, so if this is in fact the central message of the Megillah, so why did the author of the Megillah write it with all of these, you know, allusions to the story of Yosef? What's to be gained? How do those allusions to Yosef enhance this message at all? And I think that the reason might be as follows. That if in fact it's correct, which again, even if one could argue there's other messages, other themes as well, I definitely think that this message of the development into a person who really cares and takes actions and sort of feels the pain of the Jewish people like in one's gut and just can't sit by and watch things happen without taking action, if there really is the central message, or at least a central message of the Megillah, then it actually can also explain one of the anomalies of the Megillah, which we mentioned in the beginning, which is the complete omission of any mention of God's name whatsoever. But if we can now appreciate that the entire message of the Megillah is this notion of, don't just cast things on God. Don't just sit back and be like, God will take care of it, so I don't want to, you know, put my neck out. I don't want to put my neck on the line. I'm too afraid to, like, rock the boat or do anything that might, you know, cause me any personal risk or hardship or anything like that. Like, it's just sort of that notion, the opposite, theoretically, one could even in a firm way become an apathetic person by just, God will take care of it, right? And it sounds very firm, but to a certain extent, there's also the notion of ishtadlus. I almost think that the Megillah is like the book of Tanakh, which really is all about the notion of ishtadlus, of don't just sit back and throw it all on God and assume that God will take care of it. Because again, Mordechai had said to Esther, If you don't do it, it's not even necessarily that I think it is all dependent upon you. He says to her, Ruach v'hatzalah, you know, will come for another from another place. Mordechai says, I have confidence God will save us somehow else. But that's not enough. The confidence that God has the ability to figure somehow else for to save us does not give any of us the right to just sit back and say, so therefore I don't have responsibility. No, even if God will make sure it happens, we still each do have personal responsibility to stand up and take action and make it happen in our own way. But considering that I think that really is at least one of the central messages of the Megillah, and I really think, again, that this is the book of Tanakh about Hishtadlus and about this notion of each and every single one of us taking personal responsibility and taking action, it almost had to be that way, that God's name is omitted. Because the whole point is, don't turn to God. Don't just, you know, hang everything on him and assume he'll take care of it. No, we don't almost want to be looking to him at this point. We want every one of us to feel a personal sense of human responsibility to take action, and therefore his name is completely omitted, to put the focus on the human characters of Mordechai and Esther. However, I think, though, that that is precisely why the author of the Megillah keeps on having all these allusions to Yosef. Because at the same time as the author of the Megillah wants to really focus on that message of Hishtadlus and focus on the message of each and every one of us has to take personal responsibility and feel the pain of the Jewish people in our gut and feel that we have to do something whenever there's an ability, again, whether it's on a national level, a communal level, a personal level, our neighbor, whatever it is, feel the sense of responsibility to do something to help, and therefore omits the name of God, I think the author of the Megillah, though, recognizes that there is a danger of that, meaning we don't want it to become exclusively a focus on human beings to the complete forgetting of God's role, you know, and hand in things. So again, because that was the message that Megillah wanted to give, it had to omit the mention of God, because that was really the message of this book. At the same time, it doesn't want us to go so far over to the extreme that we forget that God really is, in fact, there behind the scenes. And the perfect, perfect solution to this problem of how to give the message of don't hang everything on God, you take responsibility, while at the same time do remember, though, that he's, of course, there behind the scenes. The perfect way to strike the balance is don't mention God at all explicitly in the Megillah, to keep the focus on the human characters and the human, you know, actions and intervention and, you know, taking action. But at the same time, by having all these allusions to the story of Yosef, it solves the problem. And the reason why the allusions to Yosef solve the problem is that, as we pointed out, in so many ways, the story of Esther and the story of Yosef are so glaringly similar and so glaringly parallel. The story of, you know, the meteoric rise to power from being so low to being in second in command, the hidden identities, the mishtes, the, you know, the sudden revelations, in so, so many ways they're similar. However, the most glaring, glaring way in which they are radically different is precisely this notion, which is that in Esther, the name of God is glaringly lacking, whereas in the story of Yosef, it couldn't show up more times. And if you take a look, that's actually one of the last source that I brought on the sheet, Pasuk, it's in from Rashi's Perek Lamed Tet, source number 26. And there's actually another example of it as well, which is not here, but I'll read it to you. Where Yosef, I mean, it's almost almost to the point of craziness, the amount that which he just can't stop mentioning God. Where again, if you look in, this is actually the part where he had just been brought down to Mitzrayim. He's in Potiphar's house, and it says in Pasuk Bet, "Vayhi Hashem et Yosef," right? God is with Yosef, and that's why he's so successful. And it says in Gimel, "Vayar Adonav ki Hashem ito." Not only did sort of Yosef recognize God's with him, even Potiphar recognized that God was with him. And of course, the question would be, how would he recognize that? And Rashi points out, "Shem Hashem shagur b'siv." He was constantly mentioning God. The whole Esher was Hashem matzliach b'yado. Everything he did, God made be successful. And again, then in Pasuk Hey, that from the time that Potiphar sort of established Yosef as the head of his household, Vayivarach Hashem et Beit HaMitzri b'gal Yosef, Vayivarkat Hashem b'chol asher yishlo. God was blessing everything in Potiphar's house. And another set of Pesukim that also just bring this glaringly into focus, although again, you don't have this, but I'll just read them to you, is that, so again, we even see that even Potiphar recognized that it was the hand of God that was making Yosef be successful. But not only that, even Paro ultimately recognizes this. Because in the whole story, when he has the dreams and then ultimately calls Yosef, there too, even in front of the Pharaoh himself, Yosef does not at all, again, in stark contrast actually to Esther Mordechai, who don't mention God at all, he says, Vayan Yosef et Paro, when he's going to explain the dreams, Lamor, he says, Biladai. He even explicitly says, don't think it's me who's interpreting this dream. Elokim ya'anet shlom Paro. God is basically going to sort of be telling you what's going on. And he continues in Chafei, this gracious Mem Aleph, by Yomer Yosef al Paro, Yosef says to Paro, Chalom Paro Echagu, it's really one dream that you had, et asher ha'elokim oseh, he gives the Paro, what God is going to do, he's showing Paro in the dream. And he continues, Hu adavar shedibarti al Paro, asher ha'elokim oseh arad Paro, he repeats it again, and he continues and says, and the fact they repeat it twice, it's because God is hurrying to make it happen. Everything, he just repeats God, a ton of times. Even to the point where ultimately, and this is very, very powerful, ultimately Paro himself says to his avadim, says, "Vayomer Paro el avadav, hanimtzach hazeish asher ruach elokim bo," that even Paro, when he is so struck by how accurate Yosef was in interpreting his dreams, doesn't say to his avadim, "Have we ever seen someone so smart?" He says, "Have we ever seen anyone with whom God is with him so much?" Even Paro recognizes, because of how much Yosef keeps making sure that everybody realizes that it's not him doing it, it's God. And he then says, "Vayomer Paro Yosef," and Paro says to Yosef, "Acharei hodia Elokim otcha et kol ze einavon v'chacham kamocha." Now that God has told you all this, there's nobody as smart and wise as you. Meaning, Yosef is so constantly the opposite extreme of Mordechai and Esther, in constantly mentioning the name of God, that even Potiphar and even Paro can't help but acknowledge, okay, if you're saying that it's not you and that it's God, I guess we'll have to agree that it's not you and it's God. That even Potiphar and Paro recognize that it's really God who's behind Yosef, because Yosef himself can't stop mentioning God. And that's why, again, I think that having seen how, again, Yosef and Esther are so similar, except in this one area where they couldn't be more opposite, I think might be the answer to why the author of the Megillah keeps on alluding to Yosef. But again, in the Megillah, there's no mention of God, so that we get the message of humans taking action and humans taking responsibility, but and therefore omitting mention of God, but alluding to the story of Yosef, where it's the exact opposite. Because in fact, as we know, Yosef even gets in trouble when he, at one point, tries to take human initiative, right? When he tells the Sarmashkin, "Remember me to Paro and tell him about me," right? And he gets in trouble for it. And Rashi tells us that he's actually, you know, sentenced to more years in jail because of trying to turn to a human being instead of God. And it always bothered me. Like, aren't we supposed to be putting in our hashtaglis? But again, I think the reason is because Esther is supposed to be representing one model and Yosef the other. Yosef the model of putting total faith in God, Esther putting, like, faith and responsibility in human hands. And it's therefore, again, I think by putting the two together with plots that are so similar and so reminiscent of one another, but in this particular way so different, that then it's only by seeing the two hand in hand that the perfect balance emerges of, yes, taking the responsibility, but still remembering the story of Yosef. Do remember, in fact, that the hand of God is, in fact, always behind the scenes. So and if people have questions, I'm still here, but people should feel free to go.